ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, this is Julian Morrow. Thanks very much for tuning in to The Making of One Nation, Episode 2, Define the Enemy, which looks at how Pauline Hanson's targets have changed or increased over the years, even though her tactics have remained the same. The host of The Making of One Nation is Ashlyn McGee, head of editorial innovation at The Conversation, and the series is presented by ABC Radio National. Here's Ashlyn.
If you were around in the 90s, then you probably remember this infamous line.
I believe we are in danger of being swamped by Asians.
That was Pauline Hanson's maiden speech. She came with an enemy, well, actually a few. And a warning, this is pretty hard stuff to listen to.
I am fed up to the back teeth with the inequalities that are being promoted by the government and paid for by the taxpayer under the assumption that Aboriginals are the most disadvantaged people in Australia.
The years have rolled on, and while the enemies have changed, the populist tactic remains the same. Identify a threat to blame for your problems, and then draw a clear line between us and them. Immigrants, native title, Islam, the voice to parliament, elites, it's all from the same political playbook. So what is it that makes this such a disturbingly effective tactic for populist politicians? I'm Ashlyn McGee from The Conversation, and this is The Making of One Nation. Episode 2, Define the Enemy. Ben Moffat, you're a political scientist at Monash University and one of the world's leading experts on populism. First up, let's rewind nearly 30 years and talk about that infamous line, we're in danger of being swamped by Asians. What does it mean to you?
It's where this all kicks off. I mean, we rewind almost those three decades, and I don't think we have one nation. We don't have the story of Pauline Hanson as it is today without that speech and that line specifically. But it set the scene from the get-go. Foreigners are our problem. Australia is under threat. That metaphor of being swamped. What's interesting is that wasn't actually what initially got controversy for Hanson.
We now have a situation where a type of reverse racism is applied to mainstream Australians.
Hanson attracted controversy for her anti-Indigenous views.
This nation is being divided into black and white.
This planted the flags. You know, it wasn't just about being anti-Indigenous. It was setting up a very distinct difference between impending foreign invasion, the changing of Australian culture, and defining who One Nation's real people were against that.
Do you think she genuinely believed what she was saying?
It's a good question. I don't necessarily like to play psychology when it comes to public figures, but if I had to say yes or no, I'd say yes. And the reason I say that is that Hanson's been incredibly consistent in her kind of anti-Indigenous sentiment and her nativist sentiment more broadly.
What's your view about the boat people? I said, you go out, you meet them, you fill them up with fuel, you fill them up with food, you give them medical supplies and you say, go that way.
If you know one thing about Pauline Hanson and One Nation, they really don't like anything to do with Indigenous politics, and they really don't like anyone who's not quote-unquote Australian. Like, it is an anti-immigrant party through and through, and I think people are very much aware of that. So I think she probably does believe it. I don't know why you keep it this, go to jail, you know, drag yourself through breakfast television, Celebrity Apprentice, Dancing with the Stars, launch a comeback if you didn't deeply hold some of these beliefs.
Why single out those two groups in particular? What was going on at the time in Australia and in the world?
Two big things, two big shifts. So Paul Keating had shifted in the early 90s Australia's position to this pivot to the Asia Pacific. The second thing is there'd been a number of changes, obviously around Indigenous rights, particularly after the Mabo and Wick decisions, that saw some recognition of Indigenous rights, Indigenous sovereignty. So you have those two things together, Australia moving forward somewhat into the future. In terms of the international scene, I mean, the populist radical right really kicks off and has its great successes in the 2000s. George Haider in Austria, Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, and Jean-Marie Le Pen, who started the Front National in France. So Hansen was kind of part of this initial wave that's very much in line, this anti-establishment, anti-immigrant, this nativist and authoritarianist politics that was kind of kicking off in Europe at the time as well. There's always economic factors at play, but I think saying that, you know, Hansen and One Nation's appeal is about economics is generally a false flag. This is sociocultural when it comes down to it at the core. Yes, rising costs, inflation, depressions, these sort of things can affect why people might be voting for these parties, but they're not presenting really any economic solutions. It's presenting a boogeyman, someone to blame for these wider crises.
The ideas that she spoke about weren't necessarily new, obviously, but how did she kind of bring it into mainstream politics, this idea of having an enemy?
Two things. I mean, we need to remember that she was a member of the coalition, and I think that is still how she got elected the first time. If she had just run as an independent member, I don't know if we would be talking about Pauline Hanson right now. What happens is she got booted out of the party, but was still on the ballot. So she was still there as a Liberal candidate at the time. So that gave her some legitimacy. It wasn't just, you know, full-on outsider politics. Without the media attention, this wouldn't have happened as well. She became a media darling, a media sensation. What went on is that particularly John Howard, the leadership of the time, saw the threat coming from One Nation and took and mainstreamed a lot of the policies that Hanson had put up, or at least the topics that she was putting up. So political scientists talk about issue ownership, which party kind of owns or you associate with a particular issue. And I think Howard read the kind of tea leaves where things were heading and went to own those issues around immigration and national identity with the Pacific solution, with offshore processing.
But we will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come.
People are entitled to attack the present immigration levels without being branded as bigots or racists.
To the extent that Pauline Hanson said, John Howard stole my policies.
They're One Nation's policies, again, that the Liberals have picked up from me.
And it's rare I say that Pauline Hanson is correct about something, but I think that's totally correct. I think it's fair to say that John Howard is the one responsible for mainstreaming Pauline Hanson's positions in Australian politics.
What is it about this idea of having a boogeyman or an enemy that really appeals to voters?
So you started with that line around being swamped by Asians, and that got a lot of attention at the time.
They have their own culture and religion, form ghettos and do not assimilate.
So we're talking 98 there. By the time 2001 rolls around, of course, 9/11 has taken place, and Hanson shifts almost entirely to just pure anti-Islam, and she hasn't really looked back.
You say, oh, well, there's good Muslims out there. Well, I'm sorry. How can you, you know, tell me there are good Muslims?
She experimented with targeting African immigrants for a bit there in the late 2000s when she was in her political wilderness. But I think people of Middle Eastern appearance more generally have been the targeted group that she set herself against. And I think that speaks to a broader shift kind of in right-wing politics across the world. I mean, some populist radical right parties in Europe have done the same thing. Islam has become their main target. Hanson's called for a royal commission into Islam just in general. I don't know what she was hoping to get out of that. Called for surveillance cameras in Islamic schools. Islam has replaced Asian immigration as her kind of like favoured other. But that's not to say that's the only one.
Ben, talk to me a little bit more about why populist parties really like this strategy of defining an enemy.
Well, it does a big job, especially in an increasingly connected world, of giving us someone to blame. So that's the first thing. As we live in this globalized world where global supply chains, global politics, global economics are, you know, highly complex, we're highly interconnected, it can be difficult to find one person or one actor to blame for our issues. So take the example at the moment of fuel prices. I've seen a video of Barnaby Joyce, for example, railing against how the federal government doesn't care about you.
They're more worried about climate policy than they are about you.
They're doing nothing about these fuel prices. Well, the matter of the fact is that the Australian government can't do much about what's going on through the Strait of Hormuz. But it's really good to be able to blame someone and pick on a targeted enemy. So it allows us to simplify the way the world works. And the second thing is that it allows you to, by identifying who you're against, build a constituency. So Hanson can't come out and say, I really only stand for white Australians who live in these particular areas. That would not be a politically smart decision. But you can say who you are not, and then you leave who your people are. You can leave it as broad as these are, you know, I stand for real Australians, everyday Australians. Who aren't those, though? Well, it's not Muslims, it's not feminists, it's not environmentalists, it's not members of the major parties, it's not Asians. And you can start to really draw a picture through the process of elimination and who you're against in terms of constructing your people. Now, a lot of politics does this. Some people think politics is about identifying enemies, but it is such an important part of populist radical right politics because that's how you construct your people. It's by identifying who the other is.
America is under invasion from within. We're under invasion from within.
I think there was a sense when Donald Trump came into power, how can you keep railing against the elite? You're the most powerful person in the world. You've got the highest office. But he then goes on about how he's up against the deep state, the lamestream media. So what you're able to do is, even if you're in power, you can set yourself still as an outsider. You can set yourself almost as if you're in opposition, because you're always under attack from those enemies. You're always under attack from those others. You're always defending the people against them as well. So it's not only about identifying the people, but giving you a righteous reason to defend the people, because the idea is that the people's sovereignty is always under attack from these enemies. And it's your job as the populist leader, as a populist party, to stand in their way and defend the people's sovereignty. So it's not just a strategy. It's put forward almost as this is the difference between democracy surviving or not.
Why is it that more mainstream parties don't adopt this kind of strategy?
So the first reason is that a lot of mainstream parties are still trying to be what we call catch-all parties. So we're talking about trying to construct constituencies here. They need to capture large swathes of the population in terms of who they want to vote for them. And part of that is that you go for a more inclusive or at least wider framing of who the people are. The second thing is parties do exclude. It was pretty clear the Howard era particularly went very hard against immigration, and then the Labor governments that followed kind of didn't change their policy settings very much at all. Like, there was very much a kind of closed-ish borders. Boat people were the problem. So they were still kind of targeting a particular other or enemy. I guess the difference is with radical right parties a lot of the time is that it's almost a civilizational threat rather than just a tactical one. It's like, if we don't do this, Australian society will crumble. And Hanson has said versions of this for the last 30 years. We'll be wiped out. There's almost like these echoes of the great replacement theory, the idea that countries will be overrun by immigrants with other religions, other social mores, and Australia will no longer be what it was. So I think mainstream parties do it to a more moderate effect.
I say this very delicately as someone who lived in Queensland for a very long time. And so what resonates in Queensland, and you know, that's the state of Bob Katter, Joe Bjelke-Petersen, George Christensen, what resonates there is very different from, say, what resonates in inner city Melbourne or Sydney. So how do we see this kind of singular defining of an enemy? How do we see that playing out in these different parts of the country?
Well, I think it's a really hard thing for a party like One Nation being able to gain representation in different states. Joe Bjelke-Petersen ruled in Hanson's native Queensland for 20 years with this kind of authoritarian populist regime. It's no surprise that One Nation is still very much a Queenslander party in that regard. But what flies, I think, in different states in terms of that construction of the people, you're absolutely right, is slightly different. I mean, there's a reason they don't do well in the middle of the cities. I think Barnaby Joyce joining the party is a really interesting explanatory factor. I know One Nation's rise has gone hand in hand with the coalition's identity crisis. I think by having Barnaby Joyce on board, there's that real rural authenticity, that outreach to country areas that I would be worried if I'm in the Nationals. I would be worried if I'm in Katter's Australia Party. So there's an extension of that. And I even think someone like Corey Bernardi coming on board, which will appeal to maybe the Christian right more. There is a clear move to expand, I guess, One Nation's appeal across a few wider constituencies than they might have been going for previously.
So let's play this out for a minute, Ben. One Nation continues to be popular with the electorate. It perhaps picks up more seats, state-based parliaments or federal parliaments. What happens then? Can this kind of strategy sustain it when it does have a bigger political presence in parliaments?
I think this is something that we once thought as political scientists, that once these parties would get in power, they'd be revealed for how thin their actual offerings were, how it was just targeting enemies. But that hasn't played out. I mean, populist radical right parties have become second, third, or the biggest party in a number of countries around the world where it was previously unimaginable. It works. They can continue doing this. So the idea we shouldn't worry too much sometimes about Hanson, you know, they'll be revealed as having thin policies, no policies. I think it totally misreads what people are interested in here. The only thing I would say here is after watching this party for, you know, almost three decades, I just cannot be convinced that they have the organisational nous to capitalise. Let's say this continues. Let's say they become the official opposition, which I think is not implausible. It takes years and cycles of discipline and learning to work as a party. It is only really in the last year that One Nation has had any interest whatsoever in functioning anything like an actual political party. And you see that. It's defection after defection. I almost think the best thing that could happen for One Nation would be they get into power and Pauline Hanson would resign and the party gets whipped into shape because it's still her personalist vehicle. And that's the hard thing. Does it end up looking like MAGA where everyone's in fealty to the one true leader? Or is it a more sustainable party and movement that can outlive the titular leader of the party?
Ben, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
On the next episode, as we track the making of One Nation, why the scandals just don't stick.
It's incomparable. I can't really think of another political party that has such a sort of history of dysfunction and such high-profile blow-ups.
Could it all be part of the party's grand strategy? Make sure you follow this feed so you don't miss an episode. And if you're feeling extra nice, please leave us a review because it really helps others to find us. You can read more from Ben Moffat at The Conversation. This episode was produced by Isabella Podwinski. Sound design by Michelle Macklem. Our head of editorial innovation is me, Ashlyn McGee. Misha Ketchell is the editor of The Conversation Australia. Special thanks to our colleagues, Gemma Ware, Justin Bergman and Amanda Dunn for their ideas and wisdom. The Conversation is a not-for-profit media organisation and you can sign up to our free daily newsletter by clicking the link in our show notes. You can also listen to more of our shows wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can catch the next episode of The Making of One Nation live on your radio next Sunday morning on ABC Radio National just after 7:30 a.m. as part of Sunday Extra with me, Julian Morrow. New episodes also drop weekly in this feed or just search The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen. Thanks very much for listening and I hope you can join us soon for Survive a Scandal, episode 3 of The Making of One Nation.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.